seated. First case on our calendar is 99-570, Dale R. DeRolf versus the State of Ohio. Ms. Reedy.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Watch your time there.
Before the Court today are the final reforms in the school funding system all Ohioans can be proud of. The four cornerstones of that system are facilities, accountability, standards, and funding. First, facilities. The state has committed since 1998 nearly $3 billion to the construction, repair, and renovation of facilities. And it's not just dollars promised, it's dollars spent.
Counsel, the standard that was used to set the floor, 20 out of 27.
Yes, Your Honor.
That's a standard that all Ohioans can be proud of?
It is, Your Honor. As the base cost calculation, the number that you're talking about, was updated to provide for current data and current availability, remember the standards that are used throughout Ohio were increased during this period from 18 to 27 total standards.
Okay.
The selection of 20 out of 27 total standards still provides a model group of districts that are the top performing districts in the state.
75%, would it not?
That's correct, Your Honor. Which
and
is
if the student got a 75% on the paper, what would that be?
That's the same value,
75%. Would that be a C?
It would be a passing rate, and it's the rate that districts are required to pass to get credit on the proficiency exam report card. And again, Your Honor, I think the point to stress here is that the same number of districts, 169 districts under the original methodology, 170 districts under this methodology, are the top performing districts. Those districts have the top scores, they have the top median income, and the top performance evaluations of any of the districts. There are 436 districts that perform lower than these. So the methodology is really exactly the same. The methodology focuses on who are the top performing districts according to the proficiency exams. And a further point on that, Your Honor.
Exams, those 27 standards, I looked at those. They're spelled out in the bill, itemized, every one of them. Each one of them requires, to meet that standard, requires three-fourths of the students in that class grade pass the math test, the science test. What's a passing grade?
75%.
75%.
Is what gives them that number. And the other changes to the base cost calculation.
No. On the test itself, what does the student have to score?
75%, Your Honor.
On the math test.
Correct.
To be a passing grade. Right.
And another function of what's happened in the past several years is that the as more proficiency exams have been put into place, the sixth grade proficiency exams have been put into place, and the cut score for students, in other words, that has ramped up as well. But again, I think the evidence in the record demonstrates clearly that across the board, and I would point you to Superintendent Zellman's affidavit in our record, across the board, our students' proficiency is improving. The pass rates across the board are showing a positive trend, with 95% of our students in the 12th grade passing all components of the test. The other modifications to the base cost number on that point, Your Honor, include modification in direct response to the court's concern to reevaluate the way that the base cost number was calculated. And one of those modifications includes changing the percentage of high wealth and low wealth districts that are excluded from the model group. Again, a reform that was made in direct response to the court's concern. Another component, again, of the base cost number changed in direct response to the court's concern is that the number is not phased in. And again, a particular response, a concern that the court had, that number is available today, will be available, rather, in a fiscal year, the next fiscal year. And the overall base cost number is $4,814 for the coming fiscal year, a 12% increase over the base cost number that that we last presented to the court based on fiscal year 1999 data.
Counsel, how was this formula put together? Were there committee hearings in which there was input on how you select this?
Your Honor, there was considerable work done the past year. We've tried to capture in the evidence for the court a sampling of the committee work that was done, including the end report of the Joint Committee to reevaluate the number, which was published in December of last year. And the committee working on this formula had input from a variety of sources, including Mr. Levin and Mr. Driscoll, who were helpful in terms of evaluating components of that system. By way of example, Your Honor, the precursor to the final funding formula that was put in place was Senate Bill 2, which was introduced late last fall as a result of the Joint Committee reports. One of the criticisms of that first base cost number was that it wasn't upgraded to reflect 1999 test scores and data. And as a result, direct result of that, the General Assembly went back to the drawing board and modify that to reflect current cost and current
standards.
The
reason I ask, I see in terms of updates, which if this is to work, there needs to be an ongoing review. There's contained in House Bill 94, I think at page 612 and 613, it calls for the appointment of a bipartisan committee to review every 6 years this and to
yes,
make
Honor.
Recommendations.
Yes.
But I'm wondering, was this underlying formula that we're looking at in this bill, was it the result of a bipartisan committee in which there was input and discussion as to all of these parameters that are in this formula?
I think yes, Your Honor, and the result of that committee work again is in the.
To me, it looks like what happened is a gross number was agreed on, and then you backed into a formula by doing computer runs, saying, you know, what if we said you had to meet 22 out of 27 standards, and what if we included them all? Well, you know, that spends too much money, so we'll go back. I mean, that's the way it looks. We're asked to look at this on its face. The document speaks for itself. It's been your approach to the evidentiary matters, and when you look at the document, it looks like that's the way it was achieved, rather than as a result of a studied approach to what does it actually cost.
Well, Your Honor, that notion is simply not true. And the General Assembly was well aware of the court's admonitions from DeRolf I and from DeRolf II about residual budgeting and about the calculation, particularly of the base cost number and the requirement that accurately reflect the true cost of an adequate education. And that's what this group set out to do. And as evidence of that, Your Honor, I mean, there were, as I'm sure you well know,
did they issue a report?
They did, Your Honor.
Okay.
And that report is in the record. and a number of different solutions and proposals were reviewed and evaluated. This is not the lowest cost proposal, and it's not a targeted amount. It was built up using the same methodology as Dr. Augenblick recommended to the state 4 years ago, an output-based methodology.
I would like to ask a question concerning the inventory pack and do all two. We were concerned about that because House Bill 283 provided for a complete phase-out of inventory tax by 2002, which would mean a loss of $60.9 million in revenue to school districts. Has anything been done with that? Has that phase-out been eliminated, or does it remain as it did in DeWalt 2?
The inventory tax, Your Honor, is being phased out, but one of the curious ironies and one of the great challenges facing both the state and the court as it evaluates this system is that the consequence of the inventory tax being phased out is that there is less, not more, reliance on local income tax. So for the threshold constitutional level of thorough and efficient, once the inventory tax is phased out, those dollars then at the thorough and efficient level get funded by the state if the districts can't fund that. So it's one of the endless ironies of how this works.
It's still a loss to the local districts, and you said if the districts can't fund that, what do you mean by that? If they can't pass levies?
I mean to say, Your Honor, that they don't necessarily have to pass levies to compensate for that, particularly at the constitutional threshold, particularly at the thorough and efficient level.
And when we talk about that level, it seems that we have a disparity in views about what the Constitution requires. I see that in the one of the briefs for the appellees, they speak about the constitutional birthright to high quality educational programs, and the state, on the other hand, seems to argue that the constitutional standard is an adequate education. And you know, I'm in my review that the words thorough and efficient dictionary definitions, I imagine that you've looked at those, counselor, too. The dictionary definition for thorough is simply done completely, and efficient is defined as adequate in performance. So do we say that our Constitution mandates something more than adequate?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. As school funding litigation has evolved throughout the country, obviously Ohio is not the only state involved in school funding litigation, and as the terminology has evolved, you know, and as this very court has ruled, you know, this is a question of constitutional adequacy, not a question of perfection. And it's not to say that everyone in Ohio doesn't want every student to reach their full potential and highest educational opportunity, but as a constitutional question, it's a function of where do we reach the adequacy level, where do we reach that threshold. Turning back, if I could, to facilities, the state's commitment to facilities, $3 billion since 1998, a spending rate of $1.5 billion a day, and the results, period...
You'll have it all done if you spend $1.5 billion a day.
$1.5 million, Your Honor.
All right. Let me ask you, I thought I had read that the state was spending about a rate of $300 million a year. It's higher than that?
It is higher than that, Your Honor. In statute, at the time that the facilities...
Well, let's look back. When did this start?
1998. Well, let me be accurate for you, Your Honor. The state's commitment to facilities did start in 1990, but quite frankly, until 1998, there was not the huge infusion of funding that we see today.
So from 90 to the present time, how much total?
$2.98 billion, Your Honor.
And that divided by...
And it's well. What that? That excuse me, Your Honor.
Yeah.
That figure is the allocation that's made. But I think the more important figure that people are interested in is how well are those dollars being spent, and at what rate are those dollars being spent? For fiscal year 01, the Facilities Commission dispersed $550 million which translated, has translated, frankly,
the state's effort is obviously a good thing here.
Yes.
The legitimate concern has to be what is the determined and documented need. The only number the conventional wisdom number that I recall seeing widely circulated was a $12 billion need. Is that still the operative number, or is there a more current number in terms of the overall need?
Two responses to that, Your Honor. First, 2 years ago, the state introduced the Rebuild Ohio Plan, which was a projection of all the costs for all the facilities for the state and local partnership for facilities. And that plan, which sets out a 12-year timeline for spending, commits an overall $23 billion towards the repair and renovation of facilities. Second, Your Honor, the Facilities Commission, and this is one of the changes and modifications that was made in the Facilities Commission statute to help districts, but the Facilities Commission must provide, by statute, in a 2-year period, a complete facilities assessment to any district that requests that assessment. And that complete assessment includes the evaluation of the condition of the facilities and a master plan and costing out for repair of the facilities. Because of the number of applications already made to the Facilities Commission, the director of the Facilities Commission estimates, and this is in his deposition testimony in the record, Your Honor, that by the end of 2002, over 450 complete facilities assessments will be finished. That's two-thirds of the districts in Ohio, and they're the most needy districts.
Now, you said the state has a plan in place now which will have it spending $23 billion
No, Your Honor, it's the combined state-local share. So the total renovation.
So local property taxes would be how much of that $23
billion? I think it's roughly 50%, Your Honor, but I will check on that for you. I think it's roughly 50%.
There was no longer a need for local districts to pass levies in order to participate in the construction. Is that true?
Well, again, Your Honor, a change made in the statute directly responsive to one of the court's concerns. The local district's local share is and can be generated by passing a local levy. And one of the facts and the evidence presented to the court this week is that the success rate is overwhelming. 95% of Ohio's poorest districts, over 150 of Ohio's poorest districts, have been successful in passing their local share for their portion.
But is that a requirement?
It is today, Your Honor, it is one option that the local district can pursue. So the modifications that were made to the statute responding to the court's concerns about the local share is that districts can use other means to generate their local share. But a local share is still a requirement of the statute.
But didn't both opinions state that the reliance on property tax had to be eliminated? It seems to me that this plan just increases the reliance on the property tax instead of reduces it.
That's not true, Your Honor. I think the building plan in place and the operating plan in place, both of them have this very similar feature, and that feature is it is a partnership between the state and the local district. And that partnership is what's called wealth equalized, meaning for the poorest districts, for the districts with the lowest property value and property wealth, the state picks up an overwhelming share of those costs. So for example, Justice Sweeney, for the operating costs, the lowest 10% districts, the state pays 80% on average of their total operating costs. Similarly, in the facilities program, to date, the state has paid 81% of those projects' cost.
What about the problem with phantom revenues? It seems that the higher the property tax goes in the local districts, the less the state pays, and that it's more reliance on the local authorities to raise their own money rather than the state.
I think I understand your question, Your Honor, but it's another irony of the system. The court expressed concern about the notion of phantom revenue, which, again, above the threshold level of thorough and efficient, I mean, that's where that problem, as it were, as the court characterized it, occurs. And that phenomenon stops local property taxes, again, as a form of taxpayer relief, local property
you're
taxes.
You're saying
from,
that doesn't enter into the thorough and efficient
It
definition.
Does not, Your Honor. It does not. Because at the Constitution...
Who decided that?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Who decided that it didn't enter into that?
The formula itself demonstrates that. Because at the constitutional level...
The formula the state is using.
Yes. Yes, because the state's obligation, again, and now embodied in law, the state's obligation is to guarantee to each district that each district will reach the base level of thorough and efficient. And the way that we do that, both on the operating side and in the capital side, with the minimum local partnership share.
It just seems that the burden has increased on the local property tax rather than decreased, and I think both decisions point out that was one of the main problems of the system, the reliance on the property tax. Didn't both decisions say that had to be eliminated?
Both decisions did say that the state had to focus on over-reliance on property tax, but I would submit, Your Honor, that with the system in place today, that issue has been eliminated. Remember,
There's no more, the property taxes are no longer pay the schools anything? It's been eliminated?
I think the court's decision, Your Honor, certainly did not suggest whatsoever that property taxes could not be a part of a school funding system. What the court's decision did say is that it couldn't be the primary part of the decision. It could not be the primary part. Now, the base cost number, the state share, as you get to that formula, and I'll talk in a minute about other things that have been added to the formula, but the state share of that for fiscal year 2002 is going to be 58%, and that's an increase from the last budget cycle of 54%. So what we have not done, Your Honor, if I can explain this differently, is we have not said to districts, you can't raise more for enhancement spending. We haven't stopped districts from raising funds for enhancement spending above the adequacy level if they choose to do that. What we have done, Your Honor, in response to the court's concern on over-reliance on property tax, is we've raised the threshold to make sure that every district reaches an adequacy level.
Counsel,
and that's
you use these new words, I mean, they're new to me, the enhancement spending, and you talk about the states picking up 58% of and you've got that in brief. I was going to ask Mr. Pittner about that, but since it's in your brief, the overall relationship that Justice Sweeney's asking you about of total dollars, when you take the whole state and spending for education, let's forget capital spending, just operating spending.
Mm-hmm.
The total dollars, percentage-wise, to operate all of the schools in this state that come from property taxes is what, in relation to the total state dollars under the new budget?
It is. The state dollars spent, and I'll get this figure accurately for you, but it is slightly under 50% dollars to local dollars.
It's quite a bit
overall.
It hasn't changed in the last decade, has it? I mean, we're still here a decade after this lawsuit started, and the percentage relationship is still roughly about the same, I think.
Well, those numbers, again, I think those numbers are, in fact, changing, but it's a big system. It's a lot of dollars, as our exhibit shows.
I mean, you break it out. You want to segment the property taxes. I mean, when people go to the polls and vote for an operating levy, they don't vote for an enhancement levy versus, say, a levy for the basic threshold needs. It's all part of the deal.
But what we're looking at, Your Honor, is what's the state's obligation under the Constitution?
Okay.
And as we discussed
all right.
earlier...
And let me just take you to that. I think then that's my last question to you. Is Justice Cook got into what do the words thorough and efficient mean? And would it be fair to say, given your threshold basic funding level that the legislature has determined, they took this testing standard and they determined if you meet 75% of our goals, which I think we established as a solid C, average work, then wouldn't it be fair to suggest what we substitute in the Constitution is that the legislature is required to provide for an average system of common schools throughout the state? I mean, that's really what you're saying thorough and efficient mean. If you guarantee average performance, that's it.
Again, Your Honor, I mean, the terminology of school funding litigation is wide and diverse, and the terminology used is adequacy and how to get to that level. And I would say, just on your point, again, on the 20 out of 27 standards, that as the court is aware, and again, in response to concern of educational experts and in response to the court's own point, new standards are being put in place today and will be in place by the end of 2002, standards which set out for every student what is the expectation of that student so that the student knows and parents know and teachers know. And when those standards are in place, there's going to be an alignment, of those standards with assessment test, diagnostic test, and new proficiency test and new standards. So there will be, and those categories that you're referencing, Your Honor, will change when those new standards are in place. So I strongly disagree with the notion that we're really targeting average. Again, we're looking at the highest performing districts in the state.
But you're basing money on those tests and not the new tests because they're not...
They're simply not in place. I mean, it is an evolving system.
So you can't do that. Plus, now you're going to have this federal overlay of apparently a different set of tests that they're requiring. So I assume even the new tests will have to go back and be retooled to be consistent with what the Congress has passed so that you don't have... I assume they're not going to double up on this.
Well, I mean, as the court has pointed out in its prior decisions, Your Honor, I mean, this is a complex system, and it is a dynamic system, and we are engaged now in both judicial review of the system and passage of legislation involving the system. It will evolve. This is not physics. This is a social science, and the calculations
and in
will
keeping
evolve.
With that, in keeping with that concept, counsel, is it... Should Ohio citizens be concerned with regard to this case, given the fact that Ohio has a tradition of local control of schools? I mean, are we arguing here about primary control by the state rather than local control? I mean, in terms of dollars, it sounds like the effort is to have the state take over local school districts in terms of funding. Should citizens be concerned about the input of local control in the future?
Well, that is, Your Honor. I mean, one of the cornerstones of the design of this funding system is to, again, make sure that every student in Ohio reaches the thorough and efficient threshold, but still keep local control of Ohio's 612 school districts in place. And again, in response to Justice Sweeney's concern, the part of the features of this very system, and for example, there is what's called gap aid, and gap aid is a guaranteed payment by the state to make certain that states that can't reach their minimum local contribution
gets funded by the state. Let's get back to this idea of local control. Wasn't local control eliminated when the state thought that to put in proficiency testing, generalized testing, how can you have local control? control in a school system when the state requires generalized testing?
Well, Your Honor, accountability standards, which have been endorsed by the court and have been endorsed, of course, by the plaintiffs, are now a new introduction into our education system, not just in Ohio, but throughout the country.
I don't think there's any need anymore to talk about local control. I think that when proficiency tests went into effect, but I have a very basic question I would like your opinion on. Both of our opinions stated that there must be a systematic overhaul of school funding in Ohio. Explain, the time that you have, how you see that what the General Assembly has hopefully put together is a systematic overhaul of school funding in Ohio today.
I will, Your Honor. Mr. Chief Justice, I...
Sure, you can answer the question.
Thank you. Thank you. The systematic overhaul can be found, again, in the four cornerstones. If you look at the system 10 years ago, the changes that have been put in place are the facilities funding. Accountability standards were not in place 10 years ago, and that includes, Your Honor, both fiscal accountability standards and academic accountability standards, and the record on that is impressive. The court was concerned, for example, about borrowing and excessive borrowing from districts, but that has been virtually eliminated. This year alone, only four districts will have to borrow short-term from the Solvency Assistance Fund, and then only $8 million total dollars. So there's an example of a system that is working. Third, standards are in place, which we've just discussed at length. Fourth, the state funding formulas are in place. These are four cornerstones of a systematic overhaul, again, that are now found in Ohio law. And if you look back 10 years ago, that didn't exist. And when you think about, you know, there's a lot of discussion about what systematic overhaul means, but, you know, when you overhaul a car engine, you don't throw out the engine. You know, you take it and you take it apart piece by piece, you fix what needs to be fixed. And in each instance that the court has raised a concern and started the state down this path, that concern has been addressed and has been addressed directly.
Unfortunately, your time has run out and you haven't really had a chance to even discuss the cornerstone of this, the parity aid question. There are three things that appears that are concerning some of the members of the court. First is the question of residual budgeting. The governor's brief has laid that out in terms that are unmistakable, how the system was devised, and clearly the governor understands what residual budgeting is about, and he's responded to it, I think. Secondly, you have the problem of the question of the facilities. I guess it's your position that we can only do so much logistically. By your own formula, as I multiply it out, it's going to take at least 30 years to take care of the problem that's been identified by the General Assembly as $16.5 billion. And the other thing that should be pointed out is that 272 does give each local community a chance to get certain credits against their local share and can pool with other credits. So there was an attempt at that. The third, of course, is the over-reliance on local property taxes. That's where the parity issue comes in. Would you take just a couple of minutes and talk about parity, because that's the cornerstone of this whole matter, as I see it.
I appreciate very much, Your Honor, the opportunity to talk about the parity aid program, because it goes directly to one of the court's concerns. When fully implemented, the parity aid program will provide $500 million a year to districts on a wealth need basis. And that calculation, importantly, is designed directly to end the court's concerns about over-reliance on property tax, which really at the end of the day is about the disparities that result when districts are unnecessarily abandoned, as it were, to just their local property tax. The funding formula makes certain that they get to the thorough and efficient level. That problem is solved. What parity aid does is attack that problem from above, and it gives every district in the state, every district that sits below the 80th percentile district, it gives every district the opportunity to spend at the level of the 80th percentile district. That alone is going to make a dramatic difference.
That brings each district up to what the General Assembly determined a thorough and efficient cost of education is.
It, Your Honor, it is beyond that.
Initially it does that, though. It gets everybody to that level, and then beyond that, if they can't raise enough, it supplements that.
Even without, that's not exactly correct, Your Honor, but I can understand the terminology confusion. Even without parity aid, the school funding formula in place gets every single district to the constitute to thorough and efficient. Parity aid is a supplement.
That's what I said.
And may I respond briefly to your point on the building plan? Again, the Rebuild Ohio plan has a commitment of funds to reach every building in every school district in 12 years, Your Honor, not 33 years.
Well, when you start doing the math, that's really not possible, I think. But look, at least the governor's explained that. He's given us a plan, and apparently the General Assembly has finally accepted that, too. The last point that I'd like to ask about, because it's one that concerns me, supposing we find the state's response has been appropriate and meets the constitutional mandate. I'm not asking you because I know you can't, but I'm wondering how it could be taken care of. The last time this happened in 1976 and then 1979 when the case came to this court long before any of us were here, there was a new formula in place. And the court then, in effect, in some part of it, said, well, they finally have done what they needed to do, and it's fine. And within a year after the case went away, it was dismantled by the General Assembly. What assurances would we have that this would stay in effect? Is there any way to build that into the law?
Well, it is the law. It is the law.
The law today, let's say. What's it going to be 2 years from
now? Well, every component, and again, this relates to my response to Justice Resnick's question, every component of the systematic overhaul is built into law, and those are the laws that the court is reviewing. And the laws itself, Your Honor, have assurances in them that this funding formula, which will be dynamic, I mean, quite frankly, will change, but again, it's done nothing but increase during this period, needs to be evaluated and needs to be recalculated based on new standards in place, new tests in place, new funding mechanisms in place. And that's the insurance that's in law, and there are appropriate checks and balances in place to make sure that the law is followed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Pittner.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, we are over 4 years after this court directed a complete systematic overhaul of school funding in Ohio. Elimination of disparity, dramatic reduction in reliance on property taxes, changes in the foundation formula, and a system that at the end would give our children an educational opportunity to learn to their highest potential. Where are we today? We are today where we were over 4 years ago. We have new labels. We call it different things. We call the loan fund the solvency fund. We call what was then equity aid, as the court recognized, a scrambled attempt to solve a failed system. Now it's parity aid. And again, as the court recognized in Cincinnati versus Walter, the ink was barely dry on this court's decision before the remedy at that point started to go away, and 2 years later, it was gone completely.
Mr. Pittman, Justice Douglas' question suggested that the parity aid issue is at least one of the very important points in this case. Your brief, you sort of debunk parity aid. Explain to me why parity aid does not have the impact, the effect that the state says it would have.
Okay, Your Honor. First of all, the court said we want to see by June 15th, 2001, a complete answer to the system. First of all, we won't see the reality of parity aid for 5 years. What does it amount to this year? 1.5% of the state's education budget. 1.5%, they say, fixed it. Next year, 2.9%. If it survives for 5 years, there will be money there. But where is the empirical data to show what it does and that it's needed? The state has, as in the case of equity aid, put money into the system without doing any empirical data to show exactly how it fits in providing a thorough and efficient system of public education.
Well, should we not, as a court determining a constitutional issue, should we not assume that the General Assembly will do what it says it's going to do if it adopts legislation which provides, albeit prospective, aid or formula that gets us to a desired amount 3, 4, or 5 years from now? Do we say, well, we're going to assume that you're going to change that when we're not looking, or what's your point there?
Well, Your Honor, that's been the history. They have changed it, but more importantly, the state has said two things. The court has said two things. One, the state has the burden of proof to bring before you compliance with DeRolf 1 and DeRolf 2. They haven't done that. Secondly, the state's answer, to the extent that it relies on parity aid, is a 5-year phase-in. It's not an answer today, and this court has made it clear after 2 times here to discuss this case that you wanted to see the answer on June 15th, the complete, the total, the entire answer. And
what
this isn't it, Your Honor.
What's the dollar value of parity aid in the fifth year, and exactly how does it impact?
Your Honor, I do not have readily at hand the dollar value in the fifth year. I believe it's in the briefs. It's a couple hundred million dollars. It's a substantial number.
And impacting types of school districts?
Impacting on a range up to 487 school districts based on their relationship to the one at the 489th, I believe, position. Well, that range is going to change almost annually because parity aid is yet one more kind of phantom revenue. Every district's ranking in that queue will change every year depending on their value, as will the ranking of the 489th district. So if it survives, what a district will get is going to be a very much moving target that will change from year to year, and again, depending, it is but one
Council,
more.
Let me take you to what I think the state's view of how they responded to the directive of the court that over-reliance on the property tax was the root cause of this disparity in educational opportunity that the court found unconstitutional. We said it twice. Justice Sweeney said it very forcefully in the original DeRolf opinion, and it was then again stated in Justice Resnick's opinion. As I understand their response, and I believe it is correct, is it not, that the relationship of total state spending for public education for operational purposes to this total property tax effort, it's roughly the same as when this case started out, is it not?
That's our understanding, Your Honor. It's been about 46%.
Of state
contribution, and there's no reason to believe it will change under this
one. Latest bill. That's still a relatively constant number.
I believe that to be the case, Your Honor.
But their response is that's looking at the whole basket. But if you look at the lowest wealth districts, as I understand the state's brief, has this bar chart in it. The point they seem to be making is, we haven't changed the over-reliance on
property taxes statewide when you average it all out, but we are changing the burden of property taxes in the districts where there is the lowest wealth, and therefore the property tax effort by the local citizens just won't do much for the schools. So that's where we've targeted this effort of the state. We're essentially, the state's response, as I get it, is we're not going to address the property tax, over-reliance on property taxes in terms of the entire universe, but we are going to address it with respect to the poorest, lowest wealth school districts. And so we're putting more state dollars in there, and therefore the reliance on property taxes in the lowest wealth districts has been diminished. Is that basically the thrust of the state's argument as you see it, and what's wrong with that?
Okay, thank you, Your Honor. I believe that is correctly what their argument is, and what is wrong with it is simply this. The state has conceded that there are four components to adequacy of funding. Number one, base cost. Number two, funding the costs of special education. Number three, funding the cost of disadvantaged pupils. And number four, transportation. In every instance, rather than determining the actual cost, the state creates formulas. Formulas that have no relationship to the real world, and then say, well, we funded the reality of those formulas. Their answer today is based essentially on the same system they brought before this court that was rejected by this court in May of 2000.
Counselor.
And they concede that it's based on House Bill 650, apparently failing to realize that this court rejected House Bill 650 then.
Counselor.
This is no different.
Do either DeWolf 1 or 2 prohibit properties that have greater tax base to raise additional monies for their counties?
They do not, Your Honor. The court made it very clear.
One of the things that struck me in reading all these different briefs is no matter what side you're on, you can find a statistic to support your position. Some of the statistics seem to vary depending on what brief you read, but one of the figures that struck me was Mix County, one of the poor districts, raises $900 per pupil in tax base. Is that correct, from what you understand?
I would believe that's correct, Your Honor.
And Solon raises anywhere from $10,000 to $13,000, depending on what statistic you believe, correct?
That's probably true, Your Honor.
One of the figures I read was that Solon spends $8,800 per pupil, which doesn't match what they raise, and Meg spends $6,600 per pupil. Do you know if those statistics are correct?
I do not know that that's correct.
Let's assume that's high for Meg's, that they only spend maybe $4,000. Where does the additional $3,100 come from between their property tax base and what they now spend per pupil?
They get what they get from the state, and the rest either comes from local property tax or, Your Honor, it doesn't happen. And
well,
that's the reason we have disparity of opportunity in the state.
If they're spending at least $4,000, which is a bare minimum compared to what the report was of $6,600, let's just deduct $2,000 off. If they're spending $4,000, they're still getting 75% from the state if they only raise $900. Isn't that correct?
I'll accept the court's numbers, and the answer to that, I believe, is that the court has also said this is
state,
a state system of public education. It's
so
not Meigs County's system, Your Honor.
Is if you can't raise the money locally, we're going to help you, and if you can raise it locally, you don't need our help. What's wrong with that position?
What's wrong with the position, Your Honor, is this court has twice recognized, both in DeRolf 1 and DeRolf 2, that our system is permeated with disparity of educational opportunity, that a child in Meigs County is not going to have the access to technology, the access to honors courses and advanced placement courses, the science labs, the things that will permit that child to compete effectively with the child in Solon who does have access to those things.
So what figure has the state decided is correct?
The state's figure, I believe, is $4,814, Your Honor.
And I asked you last time, and you've had a whole year to think about it, what figure do you say is correct?
Your Honor, on page 15 of our brief, we offer as an interim remedy the average expenditure of the districts who do meet the state's performance expectations, which I believe is around $6,100.
$6,100 would satisfy
yes.
you.
It is interesting to note, Your Honor, and I would bring to the court's attention, counsel relied on Dr. Augenblick yet again, and as the record will show, Dr. Augenblick went to South Carolina and said, wait a minute, children in South Carolina should have $7,257 per pupil available for revenue, and yet he comes to Ohio and offers a substantially diminished number. Now, are our children worth so much less? Are our children worth less than they spend in Michigan, in West Virginia, in Indiana, and other states around us?
Let me stop you there. We don't need that. We're talking about a constitutional standard.
Okay.
We all here, we all have as much interest in students being, young people being educated as everyone does. And so whatever someone says about value of students, frankly, is not appropriate. The question is before us is what is the appropriate constitutional standard, and has the state met that standard? That's the only issue before us.
All right. Certainly. I accept that, Your Honor, and I believe that the court has articulated what that standard is. The standard the court has said is that schools should have, I believe, the syllabus of DeRoff II. Every school district has enough funds to operate, one in which every school district in the state has ample teachers, sound buildings that are in compliance with state building and fire codes, and equipment sufficient for all students to be afforded an educational opportunity.
Isn't the issue this market basket versus the other approach, the basic sort of basic fundamental education, for lack of a better term? That's really where you and the state, it seems to me, differ, that the plaintiffs believe that every student, or at least every district, ought to have what the highest districts have, those who are able to afford by passing levies because they want to tax themselves to have more. Isn't that really the fundamental difference in your positions?
No, it isn't, Your Honor. And if I may make it very clear to this court, this is not a case about competing methodologies, whether it be market basket or some other theory. This is a case about bringing about the end result, which is those four basic things the court in 1991 directed: the end of disparity, the adequacy of funding for all children, and the reduction in the reliance on property tax. How one gets there is certainly a matter that is open to a lot of discussion. This is not a case about should we have a market basket or should we have an inferential approach. That's not the issue here. The issue is, are we educating Ohio's children to the constitutional standard articulated by this court? And the answer is we're not. And if I might point the court to one of the most egregious parts, examples of that. This court said in DeRoff II, study the buildings. They haven't studied the buildings. The court said safe buildings. The evidence, the record before this court is replete.
Excuse me. You said they haven't studied the buildings, but I read a whole bunch of briefs with a whole bunch of statistics about facility assessments, and how can we be spending $1.5 million a day if nobody has studied any buildings? I mean, could you please clarify that?
I will, Your Honor.
I mean, that's a pretty broad statement that I find offensive, because I don't think the facts support that at all.
I believe the court in DeRoff II said there should be a statewide survey of facilities. There have been, on a district-by-district study, analysis, study of facilities, and lots of them. There are 27 CD-ROMs in the record. And what those studies show that have been done is that our buildings are replete with violations of health and safety code, replete with examples of buildings inaccessible, buildings contaminated by asbestos, buildings that are unsafe for our children, and yet the state has done nothing to solve that problem.
Well, what's the $1.5 million a day being spent on if they're doing nothing?
Well, Your Honor, the state says proudly, and we don't dispute that they have built 150 buildings. Well, that is 4% of the 3,684 facilities in the state of Ohio. 4% in 11 years. Now, in the past 11 years, of those districts that over 10 years ago, 1990, were on the state's list, 20 of them still have facilities problems unsolved. We are, all of our answer to facilities is premised on two things. Number one, that states can raise the increasingly high local share that this formula will require. As their wealth goes up, their local share goes up. The court said, address the local match. They haven't done that. The court said, the 9% limit is going to make some districts unavailable, simply not able to access it. What the state did is abolish the 9% limit. The record will show that there are districts in Ohio that will have to incur over 20% of their assessed value in debt in order to access school facilities money. Is that realistic? Who's going to buy that paper?
Counsel, Justice Douglas threw out a number, and I think that's a concern for everybody on all sides looking at this case. If I understand the state of the evidence and the state of Mr. Fisher's, was it a deposition? He deposed?
He was, Your Honor.
They're doing this evaluation district by district as the districts request it, but there still has not been a statewide survey of a current survey of all the buildings.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Survey that's in place is 10 years old.
There was an update in 1997 which increased that indicated.
So it is entirely possible, it is probable, as Justice Douglas suggests, if you do the math on the spending anticipated, that as yet to be conceived children in this state will graduate from high school before this project is close to being finished.
That is certainly quite possible, Your Honor. In fact, the record before the court in DeRolf 2 indicated that the increasing cost of the rolling decay was something like $1.5 billion
okay,
a year.
I want to just for a moment take this in another direction, and that is the urban school districts. This formula that was put together, as I read the state's experts saying, they said, you know, this is certainly one way you could come about surveying what a minimum educational cost is. But if you look at the schools that made it in there, there are no urban districts. There are almost no city school districts. And still this is a number that we're looking at as the minimum basic aid. Now, perhaps the response to that is that all of those kinds of districts are spending a good deal more than the minimum level, so it doesn't matter that they're not in this particular thing. But there are a whole lot of other things that affect the spending of the urban districts where, quite frankly, most of our children are educated, or at least they go to school to be educated. And there seems to be an undercurrent in your brief now of a different, thorough, and efficient issue, and that is what's happening in the urban school districts. And there, as we're well aware, the effort, the spending effort, state and local combined, is at a pretty high level.
Yes,
the educational achievement is at a deplorably low level. Is that in this case or not? Is that
I believe it's in this case, Your Honor, in two different ways. First of all, the state has created the funding for its increase in the base cost by essentially reducing the cost of doing business factor, which has the effect of taking a lot of dollars away from urban districts, over $360 million the first year, over $400 million the second year. The second thing they've done is they've eliminated the income supplement, which also has had an adverse effect on the urban districts.
And where did that money go, Mr. Pittner?
It went to increase the base, I believe it went to increase the base aid cost, Your Honor. That's where they went. That's really how they funded it.
Went to education.
Please?
It went to education.
Well, I believe it did. I don't suggest
yeah,
they run off with
it
somewhere
else. Yeah,
you
were saying it was taken away. I wondered. Okay.
No. But with respect to the districts that the state used to determine its base cost, it didn't use 170. It used 127. Of those 127, seven of them didn't even meet the 74%, I believe, 20 of 27 standards. They had to round up to get to them. Of those districts, only nine were effective. The real effective districts were screened out by the well screens. This is the same process that was before the court a year ago in House Bill 650.
Now,
the
counsel,
same 83
given,
of the same districts.
Excuse
here.
Me.
I'm
given
sorry.
Given the you know, the briefing that we've seen and the viewpoint that the efforts by the General Assembly over the last year and the additional dollar, the influx of dollars, which I know there's a debate that there's some outgo and not enough income. Given that scenario and the what seems to be the obvious answer on behalf of the plaintiffs here, the obvious answer from the plaintiff's standpoint seems to be we have to have a tax increase. These are very large dollars that we're talking about that are deficits from the standpoint of the plaintiff's view of a thorough and efficient education needs lots more money. And I wonder if you have prepared, as last year we asked, what is the level of tax increase that you seek the General Assembly to enact to actually meet the standards that you've set forth?
Your Honor, first of all, we are not asking this court to direct the General Assembly to enact a tax increase.
How else will there be more money? As we know, the budget's complete.
Lots
of things have been cut in favor of education.
Lots of things
and secondary
have been cut. As before, mm-hmm. as was the case then, as is the case now, the state has enough money to provide a thorough and efficient education to all of its children. It doesn't have enough money to do that consistent with all of the other things it currently spends money on. And if they decide that they want to raise taxes to accomplish all of those things, then that's a legislative choice. You are correct,
Your
Honor.
Do you suggest there are some things in the budget that should be cut in favor of education rather than a tax increase?
Do I suggest
budget
cuts? Yeah,
I mean,
we're
really arguing this court is supposed to readjust the budget.
No, we're not asking the court to readjust the budget. What we are asking the court to do, as the court has twice recognized before, is to enforce the constitutional rights of Ohio's children to a thorough and efficient system of public education. That is a proper and an appropriate
but
function
for this
court.
But now we're down 4 years later. We're really down to numbers and budgeting. We're simply, that's all these briefs are about, how much it costs, where. So I'm wondering if there isn't a number that the tax increase or other budget items that should be deleted, what do you suggest be done with limited resources?
Well, as I believe Justice Lundberg-Stratton asked earlier, or perhaps you did, Your Honor, what number do you suggest? Well, we have suggested a number. Does that mean anything, though? What really is the issue before this court is not the number. It is, as we have suggested at the conclusion, a process. This court has twice given orders that have not been followed. And it is clear from the General Assembly's response that they are unable, if not unwilling, to respond to this court's order. What is necessary, I believe, is a process.
Mr. Fittner, I'd like to move to that because I think that's why we're really here. The Chief Justice has succinctly and I think absolutely accurately placed the issue before us. Is the state's response, does the state's response meet the constitutional mandate? That's really the issue that's before us. Now, just for purposes of argument, let's assume that the answer to that question is no. Now we're down to remedy.
Yes,
you have suggested in your brief several remedies.
We have, Your Honor.
First question I have with regard to that is, supposing we decide, the court should decide, that some different process should be put in place without identifying that process. During that period of time, do we return to the level of funding that exists today, thereby freeing up, according to the state, $1.4 billion, according to your reduced figure, $292 million, so that we can restore the cuts to higher education and make sure the prisons are properly staffed and the mental health systems are properly run and that the program abolished for women's interests is restored. We could take that money during that period of time and do that. Would that be your position?
Your Honor, we've suggested a couple of issues that I believe the court needs to consider, and that is, number one, since the state has chosen to integrate its response to the Deroff decisions into the state budget, if those decisions fail, as we believe they do fail, are they so entwined with the state budget that the state needs to go back and redo that budget process in the interim? That, I believe, is a question for the court. I do not propose to offer an answer to it.
The question that I presented to you assumes that we're just talking about the educational portion of the budget.
Okay, just the educational portion of the budget, Your Honor.
Now, if you say that that has not met the standards that you think they should be met, then the $1.4 billion, and let's use that figure, doesn't flow into this system, and it's available to do all the other things the state needs.
In that instance, Your Honor, we would ask the court to consider an interim funding order, as we have asked the court to consider that in the past. A second issue the court may wish to consider is whether or not there should be an additional stay of the court's orders.
If you give the stay, doesn't that return you to square one,
where we
are with regard to funding? Okay. So what you would really like, as I hear you, I think, is, yeah, we want all this additional funding the state has given us, but we want you to go further. And I don't know there can be all that. If it's not proper, then what they've provided you or provided our children, the system, is not proper either and should not go into the pot.
Your Honor, this system, the system that has been brought before the court today, is not proper. It's not adequate. It's not responsive to this court's orders, and it's very clear that a process must be in place to fix it.
Mr. Peter, let me ask you two specific questions. If the state were to do nothing else except adopt your suggestion that $6,178 per pupil be the base support, would the plan be constitutional?
What we've asked for is only an interim remedy. No, it wouldn't be constitutional, Your Honor, because we think this court has said we want to see the four basic things eliminated: the over-reliance on property tax, the elimination of disparities, the safe and adequate buildings. So no, that number in and of itself doesn't go anywhere close to meeting the directive set forth by this court in Deroff 2. Those are the mandate.
My second question is, I don't think I read this in the briefs. We all read so many briefs that I could have missed it. But is it your view that in order for a tax on real estate for schools to be constitutional, that it must be pooled?
That it must be pooled? No. 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 We have not advocated pooling, and it's certainly not necessary in order to accomplish a constitutional system. It could be done.
You've read the governor's brief. You know, I've thought about pooling for a number of years. You read the governor's brief, I take it.
Your Honor, I apologize. I have not. The court's had us on a pretty heavy schedule here. I will do so.
The governor was very, very direct and pointed with it and explained pooling in terms that I hadn't thought about until I read the brief, and it just came in late to us, so I understand you wouldn't have had time to read it. But I read it last night, and it has a whole pooling section on there, and it's pretty... It makes you think a lot about what pooling, why pooling should not be, in fact, the order of the day.
Your Honor, we have not advocated that pooling is essential as an answer to the court. Your Honor, my time has expired. May I have 2 minutes to close, or 1 minute to close? If I may, the state has asked the court to put on blinders and look at bits and pieces. They've asked the court to trivialize this court's decisions and take little parts and say we fixed or addressed or done something to each of those little parts, and therefore we've solved the system. But we ask you to look at the reality of what has happened here. This court has twice said complete systematic overhaul of school funding. It isn't here. They haven't done it. And after nearly four and a half years, Ohio's children continue to suffer the educational inadequacy and disparities that brought us here the first time. We ask this court, because we have no one else, our children have nowhere else to go. This court is their only hope. This court must and can fix it, and we ask that you do so.
Thank you, Mr. Pittner. Ms. Reedy, you've used your time, but you may take a minute for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Very briefly, in response to Justice Piper's question earlier, we have provided at Zahn Exhibit 2, that's the affidavit, Wendy Zahn Exhibit 2, the numbers for fiscal year 2000, which show the state and local share of the aggregate amount, Justice Piper, and also the state and local share of the adequacy amount. And you'll see for fiscal year 2000, the state local share, again, for adequacy amount, the amount that the state is constitutionally obligated to fund, is at 54% for fiscal year 2000. This year it will rise to 58%, and that's at Zahn Exhibit 2.
But that's a term that you all have made up. That's not a term that nobody ever looked at. The share of burden that way until you filed your briefs.
Well, Justice Piper, I think it's in fact based on the criteria and the standards that the court itself has set out.
Well, what's the state's in the over? You said you had the other number. What's
I do. It is for fiscal year 2000, 45.7%.
Okay, that's the more familiar number.
And if I may briefly close, Chief Justice.
Yes, you may.
In 1997, this court stated that Ohio stands at a crossroads. Today, we find ourselves at another one. The process, as the majority in DeRolf II well predicted, has been a very difficult one, and in Ohio's current economic climate, frankly, a painful one. But the goal has been achieved. By the standards the court itself has set out, Ohio today has laws in place, a system of laws in place that ensure a thorough and efficient system of education. It ensures that children, that school districts are not starved for funds. It is a system that ensures that children will not be educated in environments that are unsafe or not conducive to learning. It ensures the system that supplies, books, computers, and standards are in place. There will always be passionate voices for change, and there are always, always arguments for more. But today we submit Ohioans can be proud that we have crossed the threshold and beyond to a thorough and efficient system of education.
And I know you've concluded, but let me just add one thing. The Ohio Board of Regents submitted a brief late, I read that one last night, too, and it's authored by your predecessor here.
Yes.
Jeff Sutton. It's not only well done and eloquent in places, but penetrating. He says in part, however, to remedy the constitutional shortcomings in Ohio's system. Wouldn't you and I call that in the business an admission against interest?
Well, Your Honor, I
because
think...
Because it was, in fact, unconstitutional. And all the argument that we shouldn't be involved in it, I think he's admitting that now, and that brings us to today in your summation. That's why I say that.
Thank you, Ms. Reedy.
Thank
the case
you.
Is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. We'll take a brief recess.